You ever notice that politicians struggle to enact the things they run on? And that regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers cannot pass just whatever legislation they like. They are bound by the Overton window. This concept, coined by the Mackinac Center's Joe Overton, describes the range of ideas that are politically acceptable at any time. Politicians typically only act within a narrow window of policy options. On the Overton Window podcast, we talk to people who work to shift the Overton window and change what is politically possible. I'm Mike Van Beek, and joining me today is Michael Clark, who is an associate professor of economics at Hillsdale College in Michigan. Michael is also a member of the Mackinac Center's Board of Scholars. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Appreciate being here. This is a great opportunity for me, so thank you very much.
You recently received the Emily Daugherty Award for Teaching Excellence from Hillsdale. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You've been teaching at Hillsdale now for 15 years. Is that right?
That is correct. I won the award. The award actually either goes to a junior member or a senior member. It kind of alternates back and forth. And when I won it, they started announcing it as a senior, you know, it's the senior. And I was like, oh, well, maybe I didn't win it. Cause they kind of invited me and said, you got to show up to this thing. And I was like, maybe I was there for somebody else. Cause they said a senior member, but then they started describing me and I was like, oh, I am I guess I'm a senior faculty member.
as a senior faculty member, what would you say you've learned over those 15 years about, your role as a teacher and, the impact you're having there at Hillsdale?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's been quite the learning process. The way that I teach has changed drastically. Very subtle, slow, marginal shifts in what I'm actually doing. I think in some part because I have changed, in some part because the audience has changed, and in some part because the content that I'm covering slightly changes. So there has been this kind of gradation as to what I've done. But it's great because now I've seen students come through. I have students that are now professors that I, you know, taught, and I remember them being in class and, seeing them on through. So a lot for me definitely has shifted and adjusted. A colleague of mine, Gary Wolfram, who is soon to retire from Hillsdale College as a Hillsdale College legend in the econ world. I remember showing up. He's also associated with the Mackinac Center and has been for a very long time.
Absolutely.
I remember coming into work and my office is right next to his, you know, my first year or two here, and just grinding away lectures, and I'm prepping all of this stuff and creating a rough draft of the speech and then cutting it down to notes for myself and this and that, and spending just all day on what I'm going to be lecturing on the next day, and the more, you know, waking up early in the morning and then seeing Gary stroll into his office at 8:45 a.m., teaching at 9 a.m., at 8:55, going out loud, which I thought was like jabbing me purposefully, saying, now, what am I lecturing on today? Where are my notes? grabbing them and walking to class, you know, and I'm still like doing the last click. Oh, you know, can I have this? All right, I got to get to my class. I've been working on this for 9 hours. My process has become more like Gary's, you know, but it does take that effort to get there. It does, you know, it did take that initial Michael Clark to get to this more current one where I can say, oh, I've ironed this out. This one, I know what I'm doing. There's some classes where I have to super prep for it, but I kind of have a philosophy of teaching that really does rely on that learning process myself and feedback. It's a big deal.
Yeah. So how would you describe that philosophy of teaching that you have?
We're kind of tying in two things that I kind of want to talk about when it comes to teaching. One of the things that's, you know, patting myself on the back is I won an award in 2019 for the National Economics Teachers Association Best Innovation in Economics for the year. I didn't plan on submitting anything, but I went and I gave a lecture and I used this kind of game to help teach students called the Elchin Maze. And a fellow colleague of mine said, you need to get this somewhere, published, whatever. I am going to steal it. And I don't want to constantly give you credit for it while I'm stealing it, because this is so great. So get it published so it's official, it's yours. I don't want to seem like I'm stealing it. So I just said, okay, well, I'll put it out to this, you know, idea for teaching econ. And it's very simple, cheap, easy game. It basically puts a little maze on the ground of little cards, and you, it's kind of like Minesweeper, where you have to go until you get a mine and then you're done and you have to start over. But you basically try and find your way through the maze. If you get a go card, you can go to the next one and then the next one, and the next one, but you have options in front of you. And every time you get through the maze, I give you a piece of candy. And what happens is students don't know how to find their way through their maze, but they get some feedback and it says, nope, that way didn't work. And you start again. Well, it's a really great metaphor for how a market economy actually works. We tell stories of everybody figuring out the entire economy, like, oh, Steve Jobs just knew everything, or this person just knew anything. Well, there's some serious survivorship bias there, where there's other people who thought they knew everything and it failed utterly. And the reality is, you don't get those stories, right? If you ask somebody how to get rich and you only ask the people who are super rich, you're going to have somebody saying, play the lottery. You never talk to the people who lost the lottery, right? But even if you talk to Steve Jobs, he's going to say, hey, we made mistakes, but we had to learn from them. That's part of the thing, is making these tweaks. So it's a great metaphor for businesses, for the overall market economy, all of that, as to trial and error and the like, actually getting feedback that this is dumb, like this doesn't work. And one of the things that I bring up is, a lot of times in politics, that feedback mechanism isn't as good. Like if we put forward a welfare policy and it's not actually helping people, a lot of times we just pat ourselves on the back. Hey, we're doing this welfare policy. It's hard to get the actual feedback as to whether or not it works. But in a market economy, man, profit and loss, it's quick, right? So my job, my philosophy of teaching is that a lot of times we just pat ourselves on the back and are like, I'm a great professor. I know things, and however I do this, this is wonderful. And we can get stuck in bad practices. And so what I try and do is make it a little bit more like an Elchin maze. I prepare the best that I can. I put it out there and I try and get through that maze. I try and have a really great lecture, a really great style, whatever it is. But I try and not only through student feedback, because that has to be filtered to some extent. Doesn't matter if a student likes it or not. It could be good. Doesn't matter if you're, you know, loved, if you're not lovely. It's got to actually be good. So I have to filter that a little bit, but do pay attention to it, read it, and throw some of it out and take some of it earnestly and ask for it more than in more ways than what we have to get officially through like the college and stuff. But sure. Then after every single lecture, this is a practice I started probably within a year of teaching. After every lecture, I give that lecture a grade. I say, what worked? What didn't work? Could I cut this? Is this just not fun at this point in time in the semester and they need something fun? Is this, you know, could I do this in other ways? Could I do a voiceover lecture to get them this content really quickly beforehand, but then have discussion in class? Could, you know, what would try something? And sometimes it's going to work and sometimes it won't, but you just got to try a different way. And sometimes you try a different way and it's awesome. And sometimes that wasn't great. So, for example, I shouldn't say used to do, because it only happened once. It was March is kind of the middle of the slog, or, you know, end of March is kind of middle of the slog for students. Spring semester is harder because they've already gone through the fall and all that. I did a March Madness bracket challenge in my class for a week and a half, maybe 2 weeks even. Where we had like little competitions through, and teams within the class advanced to the next round and all this. It was meant to be kind of fun, but like, hey, we got to be serious and know your stuff and come in. It didn't flow the way I thought it would. The way, you know, it could sound like, oh, that'd be really interesting and fun. No, it didn't work. So it lasted a year, got cut, you know, even though it was kind of fun to get through, and that was something that was needed at that time, something a little different. That just didn't work with the content as well. And so I cut it. So my teaching philosophy very much so is that Elchin maze. Yeah. Trial and error is how I can be smarter than me. I'm not that good. I'm not that smart. I don't have like a, this is exactly how you teach. And, you know, I've studied this and this, and I know everything. I view mankind in a market economy as somewhat kind of limited cognitively, but we become incredibly creative and smart through the invisible hand process, through spontaneous order, through that trial and error with profit and loss. Yeah. We come to incredible solutions that you couldn't have thought of, you know, just on your own. But when it gets through that filtering mechanism, it's great. And that to me is really my philosophy of teaching. How do I become smarter? Because I'm not that smart. I'm not that great. But if I can go through a mechanism like that, I can become, you know, much better than I am just trying to think. Because when I try and think, I come up with March Madness. And, and it ain't great, turns out.
Yeah. So would it be the case that the classes that you taught when you started at Hillsdale look very differently now because you constantly have been reiterating and updating and tweaking and customizing them based on the trial and error process?
For sure. So I think a lot of students would recognize the tone of my class, you know, my basic management of, you know, how you operate and, you know, kind of like the syllabus structure of, hey, I'm going to be tough, fun, and fair. That's, you know, the goal here. And students appreciate that if that's upfront and how you operate a class. But in terms of me actually executing the content, it's quite a bit different. And even, you know, some things stylistically, in terms of examination and things have changed, but it still is from that same who I am as an individual. An example of this, actually a COVID thing. We got shut down. The governor in Michigan was, you know, really strict.
I know.
Not that Mackinac's dealt with that at all. you know, we got shut down one of the times, basically right before finals. Like we, came back or we dismissed for Thanksgiving break and basically didn't come back.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I had an elective class where we gave essay questions. I gave essay questions in advance. I gave them like 20 essay questions. I said, two of these will be on the final. These 20 essay questions are basically what we've talked about for the entire semester in Austrian economics. Some people had started studying in earnest for that. Some people hadn't touched it. Now we're dismissed. How do I exam on this? Because an essay, they could, you know, some people could look stuff up. Open book, it's too easy based on the questions that I gave. So what I did was I said, you know what? I'm going to do oral exam just like this. If you're cheating, it's going to be rather obvious to me that you're constantly looking at your notes or whatever. I even said, honestly, if you want to create an outline that you could glance at for just reminders, fine. But I'm going to, you know, can you have a conversation about the class that we've had on these essay questions? In the first 2 minutes, not even that, first 60 seconds, I knew what their grade was, but I let them go for 9-10 minutes or whatever, just so that they felt justified in like I earned my grade or not. But they would know it. And I could give them instant feedback.
Sure.
Which my whole philosophy here of like feedback matters a great deal. And it does in the research, like in terms of learning, if you give a wrong answer and you let it go for a week, your brain thinks that's the right answer, even if you weren't sure about whether or not it was the right answer. Well, if I tell you right away and explain it to you and then have a little mini conversation with you and repeat it back, hey, that's another chance for me to help you learn. Also, this is the real world. You got to have a conversation with somebody, not sit down and, you know, you never ask somebody a multiple choice question when you're at work, right? Like, hey, do you know, is it A, B, C? You know, it's not, this is more reality. And I felt that from giving that. So now in that class, I give an oral exam at the end. And that was just through trial and error and like being forced into a different situation. I do a lot of different things in different classes. There's classes where I shut off PowerPoint. I don't have anything there. And I do traditional chalk and talk to work them through a problem or a graph or some concept. I do stuff that's flipped classroom where I give them the content ahead of time, but then we have discussion in class or test them in class with problem sets. I have some classes where it's worked best where I just tell the big overarching story and I hit it emotionally and I tell them why they need to go read the textbook and figure out the graph. And other times I help them through the mundane, you know, or whatever. And through trial and error, I feel like I'm probably wrong with how I address some of those, but I get to the root of how can I help them the best, and what style works for me the best in these various classes. So they have, you know, some lectures are exactly the same as they were, but very, very few. And they get these little tweaks here and there. And that to me would be, or has been really my advice to students that become professors or teachers, is steal from those that you know and you like. Steal that. That's what we want. Steal. And I give them my stuff. I say, here's what I developed. But also, you can't be me. You're not. So find your own way to kind of evolve this to your style. I can't. There's some professors out there, Gary Wolfram being one of them. I think he's great. I can't do his style at all. I don't understand it. To me, it's crazy. He does these review sessions and he tells you everything that's going to be on the exam. And I'm going, what? It's so easy. You know, like I don't, but you know what? People leave his class and they know a lot more stuff and his style is his style. He said to me, hey, you got to teach me how to use PowerPoint someday. That's slick. You know what you're using? That was really crazy. I'm like, Gary, no, you can't be me. I can't be you. But steal from people and then go through that trial and error process to make yourself smarter, better than what you are at the start. Don't just justify how good you already are by telling yourself you've got it all figured out. Kind of actually mentally assess how well did this work? You know, how's this going for us here?
You mentioned earlier that often in the policy world, this kind of trial and error stuff doesn't happen as much as it should. Can you talk more about that? You know, why doesn't that happen? Why don't policymakers approach policy the same way you're approaching your teaching?
Yeah. So, I mean, to me, I love a brand of economics called public choice economics. And that's basically just the economics of politics. So looking with a critical lens at how politics works, what the incentives are, things like that. And it's really just down to, it's not, you know, nobody cares if welfare works. I think everybody cares if welfare works well, or if a minimum wage policy works well, or some regulation on this. It's just not clean feedback mechanism. So the incentive structure isn't as tight as it is in a market setting. A lot of politics at its core, at its foundation, is voters. Right. So voters elect officials and then officials have to do things based on what the voters, you know, desire and what's within the Overton window that we have. Right. Well, if voters are at the root, think about it. If I'm a voter and I care greatly about helping the poor and I vote in favor of a minimum wage policy, I, as an economist, would argue that hurts the least among us more than it helps them, much more. It takes away opportunities because what businesses do is say, hey, I have to pay you $20 an hour and you're not really actually worth $20 an hour. You're low-skilled labor. So I'm going to replace you with a machine. So now that low-skilled labor never gets on the kind of ladder, you know, gaining the basic skills of showing up, being professional, you know, what's expected at a job. So now they can't get the next job. And I think there's all kinds of negative ramifications for that. When we have a minimum wage policy, we get unemployment, from the least among us, right? But as a voter who doesn't know economics, and I say, hey, elected official, go get that minimum wage policy. And they do, and they put it in place. What's the next step? The next step is I get to pat myself on the back and, you know, as Thomas Sowell says, self-congratulation as a basis for public policy. I get to feel good about it. I get to congratulate myself. Politicians get to congratulate themselves because they did what they wanted for you. It seems like it would help. There's a heart behind it, but it doesn't actually help. So do we ever get that feedback mechanism? The only feedback mechanism we get is this long run. Hey, there's still poor, low-skilled labor out there. And maybe we're not doing enough. It's not saying, oh, it's a result of the minimum wage policy. How could that possibly be? That's dumb. That's helping the poor. I never get that feedback if I don't understand economics. And so then I think, well, we need to do more stuff. Okay, yeah. So now we need to have this policy that probably hurts also. And so the incentives and the feedback mechanism is just not as tight. It's much harder to get that feedback in policy than it is in a market setting. And so that's why me, as somebody who advocates for more free market economic stuff, that's a big part of the reason why. It's not that I don't have the same intended goals as people on the left or the right. I would like to help the poor. I would like to have, you know, whatever it is, better business practices and things like that. It just, does it actually work when we get that filter mechanism through public policy or through the market setting? And there's debate there. That's fine. But to me, it's just harder to have it go through policy because what is the feedback? It's much less clear than when a company doesn't make dollar, you know, doesn't have that. And so how do you help the poor or something like that? It's not going to be through necessarily, you know, capitalism and the private sector doing all these things. But what I hope would happen would be churches, more local governance, other things like that. They're going to have a tighter feedback mechanism. They're going to know the person they're trying to help. They have that ability. We just can't do that through big government programs. And so to me, that's always been kind of part of what makes me more free market or local government federalist approach in terms of my policy issue or my policy stances, because you just argue to me, what is the feedback that these politicians are getting that is actually helpful? That's actually refining what works and doesn't work in a positive way. It's a very slow, long-run process at best.
Yeah, there is a process of some kind. You know, the legislature has committees and they take testimony, and they have, state departments that manage these programs, and they're supposed to provide reports to the legislature about how well it's working and all these kinds of things, but. It doesn't seem to make a difference. It seems like policymakers this is kind of what I'm getting at. Like, why don't they take advantage of some of that information? Maybe they don't have good enough information, but it seems like they're not interested in figuring out whether or not their policies are working.
Yeah. The call to get rid of the feedback or to just, I think there's some ideological kind of stuck in there, like, hey, we're going to do these kind of things. Oh, it's not working. Well, it must be because, you know, these other things. So, okay, but, you know, we're going to keep doing this and, you know, we got to help the poor. So minimum wage, I know it's not working perfectly now, but maybe it will. And by the time anybody maybe would actually listen and overcome their ideological biases that are in there, those politicians, it rolls over, there's new politicians there, or they have to serve their constituents. The voters at the core, again, aren't getting that feedback. I'm not saying it's non-existent. And in fact, I think long run, there's some benefits to these kind of policies, and especially having oversight committees or just kind of some kind of auditing of what's happening. I'm all for that, but it's much weaker. And you know, all of us are this way. If we have a deep-seated belief, even having feedback on that thing, it's very hard to change our mind on that deep-seated belief. Most people don't go into politics with an open mind and perspective on what will help Michigan the best. They go in with here's what will help Michigan the best. They had to run on that platform or else they're not getting elected. They have to have that kind of mindset or they're not there. And so then once they're there, what's feedback for? Like, you already know the answer, right? And that's the different mindset. The political system does not, by its nature, put in place those who kind of question whether this will work or not. That's the filtering mechanism to get people there. So when you have people who are more open-minded or questioning it and want the feedback and willing to change their mind, they seem like these total outlier anomalies to us. They're like, it's why, how do you exist? Right. like, what are you doing there? So they do exist, but they're, you know, quite infrequent. And again, that's, you know, part of the selection policy of that's the institutions that we're running. I say in my classes, the way I say this is, there's no such thing as Ron Swanson, right? You don't go work for the Parks and Rec Department because you believe in limiting the Parks and Rec Department. Like, that's just a weird.
There's a reason why that's a character in a sitcom.
Yes, right. it's a weird thing. We're all Leslie Knope. There are no Ron Swansons. If we're in there, there are exceptions. Again, there, you know, you go through and you say, oh well, this guy or this, but it's very limited in terms of that. And so, a big part of my political philosophy, teaching philosophy, is all roped into this idea of what I learned about economics was we don't know. I think that's the deepest thing I understand in economics, is this concept of spontaneous order takes us to where we don't know and we can't figure it out. We can't plan an economy, top-down socialism type stuff. It's failed, and there's reasons why it fails over and over. It's not because it was the wrong people, but there is a reason why we'd have the wrong people, but it's not because of the wrong people. It's not because we can't figure that all out without the help of, you know, the system. The process of trial and error makes us smarter than we are. One other teaching mechanism that I have that showcases this, I think, really well. So I have this, I don't have it on me. I could physically show you. I have this bag of Legos. Okay. So I have Lego. And, you know, you can imagine going into the Lego store and they say, hey, as many Lego as you can fit into this bag, it's $20, right? Or I guess more realistically, $120. Because I don't know when Lego got so expensive, but super expensive. And so if you take this bag and I give it to you and say, hey, I'll give you, you know, 10 seconds. You can take each piece and kind of move it around and push it and prod it and do whatever you want to try and minimize the space in the bag so that you can put more stuff in there. You can be smart and, you know, take each piece and move it to where it should go. I can give you 20 seconds, you know, whatever, and do that. And that's fine. And you can do some things well. But if you instead just take the bag and shake it, things settle to the bottom.
Oh, yeah.
The Lego aren't smart in figuring this all out, right? But in that setting, in that institutional setting, they kind of get this little profit and loss thing. Oh, I ran into a piece here. I didn't hear. And they find their way to the bottom. Well, that's us. The Lego aren't super smart, but if you put it in the right environment, the Lego find their own way, right? To me, that's a market economy right there. We don't really know our way forward. We can be smarter and work harder and those kind of things, but really we're just Lego and we need to be in the right environment to find our way forward creatively. And that's the deepest thing I think we understand in economics, is that we don't understand the solutions to how an economy should be set up, where all the pieces should go. We can't figure that out. But what we've discovered is this idea of spontaneous order. And there is a filtering mechanism that gets us to solutions that we could never even possibly have imagined before. And now they seem commonplace to us. That has been ingrained in my soul. And I love the opportunity to kind of spread this to others to at least think about that concept. Because to me, that's the deepest thing that we understand as economists, and me as a teacher and an economist.
Yeah. Yeah. And it would make for a very good campaign slogan. To say, you know, I don't know what to do. Let's try some things and see what might work. You're not going to get
I'm not off sure of a clerk. I'm not sure, but somebody else will have ideas, and a lot of them will be wrong. But somebody else will probably figure this out in some way that's unexpected. But me, I'm not going to do anything, and I have no clue. Okay, buddy, you're not in charge, you know? for sure.
Yeah. Well, thanks. Thanks, Michael, for joining us. We're all out of time already, if you can imagine that. But it went by very quickly. Thank you for spending some time and sharing your teaching philosophy and your much broader philosophy about life and policy and everything else. So really appreciate it.
Yeah. Blessing to me. Great opportunity. So thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinaw.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.